from the U.S. to India, and so, inevitably, are the thoughts of some who left India for America. Tonight on Point, Indian Americans on the rise of India, the future of America, and what they think now about their family's decision to emigrate to the USA. We begin tonight in Washington, where India's Prime Minister Manmohan Singh met today with President Bush. Caroline Daniel is White House correspondent for the Financial Times. She's been following the meeting of superpower and emerging power and joins us now from Washington. Caroline, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what has Prime Minister Singh brought at the top of his agenda for President Bush to consider?
Well, he's brought many things at the top of his agenda, and he hasn't got all of those things delivered to him. But what we've just learned in the last hour is that President Bush has given him a big concession on nuclear, the development of nuclear energy in India, and effectively shaking his hand as a nuclear power for the first time.
This means the United States will provide nuclear technology to India?
It means that probably a number of things. It means that President Bush has agreed to lift some restrictions on transferring nuclear fuel and other technology to India, which had been in place since 1998, when India surprised the U.S. and the rest of the world by carrying out nuclear tests. And so for the last 7 years, it's been ostracized as a nuclear power, hasn't signed up to all the international agreements. And today there was a big move by the U.S. effectively saying, that's in the past, we're going to look to the future, we will now work with you on civilian nuclear energy if you agree to sign up to some more restrictions on your own nuclear power.
Does it mean that India will be part of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Pact?
The statements are not clear on that at the moment. It doesn't say that they're signing up to that, but it does imply that they're signing up to a number of other international agencies and their overview. So I think this is an important moment in terms of India as a nuclear power.
And a significant concession from Washington. They were shocked by India's test in 1998. And, of course, Washington has tried to stay close to Pakistan, which has its own nuclear program.
Well, absolutely. It has very interesting geopolitical implications from this about how we look at how the U.S. looks at Iran, how it looks at other countries which are trying to develop their own nuclear military programs. In effect, this is a big moment for how we can actually go forward on nuclear relations from the U.S. But it's also a significant change on the relationship that the U.S. had with India 30 years ago, when you had Henry Kissinger in the height of the Cold War basically lambasting Indira Gandhi as a witch and denouncing the Indians as vicious and cowards. That was at the height of the Cold War, so we've come a long way in the last 30 years to where we are today.
A time when India and American relations were in the deep freeze. India was much more oriented toward the Soviet Union. What else on the Prime Minister's list for Washington?
Well, the thing that he didn't actually get much progress on today was India has been seeking a permanent seat at the UN Security Council as a mark of its status and the fact that it really is becoming a very strong global power. The U.S. has basically not endorsed that move and, in fact, has tried to make sure that a vote on this does not happen yet. The U.S.'s priority at the moment is to try and reform the U.N. It has lots of concerns about corruption at the U.N. and doesn't want to get into a difficult political game about which countries are allowed to become permanent members. So that's something that the Indians have not achieved in the talks today.
And what about from President Bush's side? What does he seek? What does he need from India?
Well, various analysts have different views on that. I guess the most basic view is that it's a growing power in an important area of the world, particularly looking at relations with China going forward. So more Kissinger-type analysts, I suppose, would say this is looking at developing up India as a counterweight to China in the future. So if you can have good relationships with India now and close ties on things like nuclear power, and indeed as a growing economy, that's going to be very important in the next 10, 15 years.
The Bush administration doesn't really put on the dog for visiting dignitaries, but we see images today of Indian flags fluttering around Washington, the real red carpet treatment for Prime Minister Singh.
It has been an amazing day. They have a dinner tonight, which is going to be attended by lots of Indian chief executives, American chief executives. Laura Bush is turning out. They've flown special flowers in. They have a special menu that we were sent. In terms of what they're going to be eating tonight. It's going to be quite the show. And you're right that there are very few. It's not actually officially a state visit. because he's only a prime minister. I think he only gets a 19-gun salute instead of a 21-gun salute. But nevertheless, it's quite the turnout. And also, it will be followed up by a personal trip by the president to India either later this year or early next year.
So a real stepping up of the kind of quality of the relationship here. Caroline Daniel, thanks very much for filling us in tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Caroline Daniel, White House correspondent for the Financial Times. She spoke with us from Washington. Once upon a time, and not so long ago, India brought to mind poverty and a great but backward-looking culture. Today, India is synonymous with outsourcing, globalization, technology, and economic boom times. For anyone, it's an exciting story. For Indian Americans whose families left India in the last 10, 20, 30 years for the USA, it is a head-snapping moment, a moment of pride in the old country, but also an intimate lesson in the light-speed changes of a globalizing world. They came for the American dream, and now big pieces of that dream are in India. Some are rethinking their relationship with India, reestablishing ties with old friends and family, investing in real estate, considering dual citizenship for themselves and for the children they brought to the American land of opportunity. For these Americans, India's rising star is making a dynamic relationship more complex and interesting than ever. Tonight, we will hear from them. You can join the conversation. Immigrants from India, are you still glad you came? And now that India's economy is booming, are you looking back to the old country? Can you believe how quickly things have changed? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is Mitra Kalita. She's a business correspondent for The Washington Post and author of Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. Mitra Kalita, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us tonight from Brooklyn, New York, is Suketu Mehta. He is author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found, terrific book. His essay, A Passage from India, chronicles his experience as an Indian immigrant to the U.S. It appeared last week in the New York Times. Suketu Mehta, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Tom, for having me on.
So here we are. What an interesting moment. Your prime minister is in town. He's getting concessions from George Bush on the nuclear front. We read about India every day in the headlines. If you read Tom Friedman in the New York Times, he makes it sound like the Second Coming, the promised land unfolding there. So, Suketu Mehta, you've written recently about this and said, noted that, wow, what a turnabout here. How does it feel to you as an Indian American, an immigrant yourself, to see India booming up this way?
Well, Tom, I came to this country in 1977 when it took a lot of Americans some effort to find India on the map.
Right.
And when I went to a school in Queens, New York, they really didn't understand what part of the world I came from. This has changed, and we now find in the pages of the New York Times, certainly in the magazines, this recognition that India and China are going to be the 21st century's rising superpowers. Mm. India is also going to be the largest country in the world in terms of population by the year 2050, and not all of those people will be dirt poor.
And you write, Suketu Mehta, that you're making sure your children learn Hindi. What about the whole decision to come to the States? Does it look like a funny timing now that things have changed so much in India in the years since you came?
Well, my father came here really to give his children a better economic opportunity. And now when I go back to Bombay, I find that the friends of my age who stayed back there have in some ways a better quality of life than I do. It's still relatively cheap compared to the United States, but often they're earning American incomes fitting right there in India. So the dream that many people left India was, it wasn't really for the American dream that they left. They didn't come here for its political freedoms or its way of life. The idea was to wake up in your Indian home and have an Indian breakfast every morning and commute to an American office.
With an American salary.
With an American salary and come back home to your grandmother's home cooking.
Right.
Now, this is something which you can realize sitting right there in Bangalore.
And you don't have to go all the way to the U.S. So get to Matt to stand by for a moment. Mitra Kalita, how do you see it? When you talked with Indian American families for your book, Do they feel conflicted about the fact of their emigration? Are they glad they came here? Are they looking back to India and saying we should have stayed, or that this is just a great time to have a foot in both cultures?
Well, I think the world we live in now, it's very possible to have a foot in both cultures. So, in fact, as we're speaking right now, I just got word from my parents that their property in India, the home that they've just built, is being painted right this week.
Okay.
So it kind of gives you a sense that, you know, they have a home in suburban New Jersey and they have a home there. And
You're saying that they have both?
That they have both. And that, you know, the 18-hour plane journey that we once used to take just every 3 or 4 years is now something that, at least since I've hit my 20s, I've taken every year and gone to see family, as well as in my line of work, I've as a journalist been able to write quite a bit about India's economy. So for the families I interview, as well as my own family, I think that this back and forth and the notion of the world becoming a lot smaller is really fueling their ability to see, you know, almost have the best of both worlds.
What a unique situation you're in, along with others that we'll speak with tonight. Mitra Khalidi, Sukhita Mehta, please stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight with Indian Americans about the rise of India, the future of America, and what they think now about their family's decision to emigrate to the USA. Immigrants from India, are you still glad you came? And now that India's economy is surging, are you looking back to the old country? Which country, new or old, would you bet on long-term? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. By Wellington Management, providing investment management for clients worldwide. And by Corey McPherson Nash, a design firm developing branding, print, and interactive communication solutions. Thoughtful design embedded in creative strategy.
Has the world changed the immigrant experience? Does it mean it's not a one-way trip anymore? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I've been joined tonight from Washington by Mitra Khalidi. She's author of the new book Suburban Sahibs, Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. From New York, Brooklyn, by Sukhetu Mehta. He's author of Maximum City, Bombay, Lost and Found. And right now with me in the studio in Boston, Gururaj Deshpande. He joins me right here tonight. He's co-founder and chairman of the high-tech company Sycamore Networks, among several other companies. His first startup, Cascade Communications, was sold for $3.7 billion in 1997. He hasn't done too badly in the United States. Desh Deshpande, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Tom.
So we're just getting a whole gang together tonight with Prime Minister Singh in town to just look at this experience of the Indian immigrant and what that must feel like now. We could be talking with Chinese Americans tonight about what it looks like to see China booming up. Share your thoughts with us. When you look at the Indian immigrant experience, when you get together with fellow Indian Americans, are they looking back to India now? Are they still fully rooted here? Are they thinking, hey, it's time to be global citizens with a foot in both cultures, both economies?
Yes, it's definitely very interesting. You know, I left India in 1973,
mm-hmm.
and used to go back maybe every couple of years or so. So always sort of has had touch with the country,
mm-hmm.
but most of the visits used to be family visits. Except about 5 years ago, I did start a company, so now I have a business interest, and it's interesting. So when you go back home, it's not just talking about families, but you can talk about the businesses that are emerging, and a lot of the companies look very global, and they look very much like the companies in Boston.
But Desh, what about this experience of immigration, the historical experience when you had to sail to America? It was dangerous and all the rest. Was you really left the old country behind, and maybe you stayed in touch culturally, but for many people in economic terms, even cultural terms, it was gone. Now it's a globalized world. Travel is easy. Economies are integrated. Do you think Indian Americans are going to have are they going to float back to India? Are they going to have a less tight relationship with the United States? Or are they, and I know they is a big word here, it's a subtly nuanced field, I'm sure, but are they going to, you know, be fully rooted here or something else?
Actually, it's something that's changing, not just for Indians, for everybody, including every citizen of the United States.
We see lots of dual citizenships emerging with many countries.
Well, it's not just that. You know, I think a lot of it happened, you know, in the bubble, We talked about the internet and how things got overexcited, overheated. But all of that is coming true now. You know, we live in a connected world. And what the internet has done is that value creation has the same value irrespective of where it gets created now. So it doesn't matter whether you're a U.S. citizen, Indian citizen, or a Chinese citizen. Whenever you try to do something, you try to do it globally. And so I think there's a tremendous amount of interest on part of Indians coming to the United States learning about India, but there's an equal amount of interest on the part of United States citizens who want to travel to India and learn and understand about what's happening in India.
We hear a lot about borders becoming less important, and this may be an object lesson. Sukheta Mehta, when I was very young, I spent a year in India. This would be in the mid-late 70s. And at that time, it was impossible to imagine, as an American, that this would someday become a competitor nation. I mean, the poverty was so universal, and high technology was something you just didn't see much of in the mid-70s in India. When you talk to Indian Americans now about the future, where do they see it, Mr. Mehta, in the United States or in India?
I think it's both places, but it's nice to finally be betting on a winning horse. And for such a long time, we've gotten used to these images of India with starving cows and starving people. It's nice now to have all these flags flying at the White House for our Prime Minister. But we can't forget that India still has the world's largest underclass, that malnutrition rates in India still exceed those of sub-Saharan Africa. So there is a very rapidly growing middle class, and the economic indicators of the country are on the upswing. And most importantly, it's maintained a successful democracy since independence. But it's far from clear that the speed at which the money trickles down to the rest of the country will keep up pace with people's expectations. Things could still go wrong.
But what we hear is, I mean, we realize a quarter of the billion people there live below the poverty line, but what we hear is that that leaves an enormous population that's middle class and better, even if there's a very large population in poverty.
That's right. So anything about India is huge. I mean, if you say only 2% of the country can read or write English, that's still 20 million people. The numbers of rich are huge and the numbers of poor are huge. But what's new is the emergence of this giant middle class, which is also well represented in countries like the United States. Indians who come here are in many ways the cream of the crop. We are, along with the Japanese, the richest ethnic community in the United States. So it's somewhat easier for us to feel optimistic about the country than someone sitting in, let's say, the Indian state of Bihar, for whom things haven't changed very much for several generations.
Which is not a Bangalore, which is not a cutting-edge area. Mitra Kalita, with the Indian-American families you talk with, as Sukheta Mehta says, Indians are one of the richest ethnic groups in the United States, had made tremendous progress in the 90s, boomed 10% of all startups in Silicon Valley in the 90s, Indian-Americans. Right. This year's National Spelling Bee, we all saw it, top four contestants of South Asian origin. When you talk to Indian-American families, where do they see the world's economic future? Where do they see their own futures?
Well, they're very proud, I think, of that success. And I do think that with the recent attention to this, you know, it used to be most people's reference for an Indian on television was Apu on The Simpsons, right? And suddenly when you have winners of spelling bees or CEOs being interviewed on television, there has been much celebration in the community. What I'm also seeing is exhibited in some of that pride is almost a striving to be authentic in being Indian. So you're starting to see more Indians come to the United States, and they'll take Hindi classes here, whereas they might not have spoken that back in India. I did a story for The Post about an Indian dance competition that a group of students at George Washington University were holding. And the judges actually deducted points if you remixed your Indian folk music with rap music or hip-hop or anything like that, as we might often hear Indian music on the radio.
They want the old, true thing. But what about, do you see, I don't know, patriarchs of Indian-American families smacking their foreheads and saying, I went to all this trouble to come to the United States, and now, you know, the big sizzle is in the Indian economy. Why did I do it?
I haven't seen that yet, and I think if you go to a U.S. embassy in a city like Bombay, you will still see lines and lines of people trying to get into the United States. I don't think that the hunger to immigrate to America has waned on that front. I still have cousins strategizing with various, you know, computer code languages and what can they learn to get over here. I do think it's lessened and that there are more people who see a future in India, but I would think that those lines at the embassies are an indication that the American dream is still very much alive overseas.
So watch the line at the embassy. I want to invite one more voice into our conversation now. With us in the studio, Rushika Dua. She's a 23-year-old Indian-American about to enter medical school at George Washington University. Rushika, thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us your family's story. When did they emigrate to the U.S.?
Well, we immigrated to the U.S. in 1993 with my mother, who was a nurse who was employed in one of the hospitals in New York, and our family followed soon after.
So you were, what, 10 years 11, old, 11 years 11 old years at that old. Time. And now when you sit around the kitchen table, I'm sure immigrating is never easy. It involves sacrifices and, you know, years of integration and all that work. When your family sits around the kitchen table and talks about being in the U.S., how do they talk about it? Are they glad they came?
Well, there are mixed feelings. We came at a time where India had started to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still mixed feelings. I'll still hear from my father who says he wants to go back.
Mm-hmm.
But there are certain sentiments as well that keep us here. There are reasons that pull us towards India, towards settling in India, but there, at the same time, there are reasons that make us stay here.
Describe those for us, the things that pull you toward India, the things that root you here in the United States.
Well, the major pull would be family. The major pull is family. But
back in India, the whole extended family there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. They're closely knit families, and that's the major pull.
Mm-hmm.
But other pulls, I mean, now things are coming up, and they're very exciting, the new things. Like, this is whole part of the globalization process.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a very exciting time to be there.
You've just been back to India.
I was just there. I returned almost a month ago.
And how did it feel? Can you feel the surging economy?
Oh, most definitely. You can see the change. I have been a witness, and you, Mr. Desh, you have returned just yesterday, and
right.
I'm sure you can witness the differences as well. The infrastructure has just changed enormously. I mean, I travel to India frequently, and I cannot recognize some of the roads that used to be in India.
They're so built up all
they
of a sudden?
They are built over. Highways have, I mean, there are no plain roads, I have to say.
No plain roads, meaning?
Well, There used to be there used to be roads in India where everything went, even cows.
Right,
and, you
of course,
know?
Right. The bus and the cow
exactly.
and the scooter and the
exactly.
And the ties that you feel keeping you linked to the United States.
Well, the stability. Really, the opportunities that exist here, I know. I don't know if I would have the same opportunities if I were in India. The competition is very tough. I mean, I am an entering medical student, and
mm-hmm.
I thought the competition in the U.S. was tough. But to hear the numbers back in India, it's just mind-blowing.
But I don't know what that means, Desh Deshpande, for the future of the U.S. economy. If the competition is that much tougher in India, that suggests a different standard is being met. In India.
Right. But at the same time, you know, I think these things, pendulums swing too much one way or the other.
Mm-hmm.
73, when I came, everybody here thought that we had cows and elephants and all that kind
right.
of stuff. But now, suddenly, everybody here thinks that there's a billion geniuses,
right.
computer scientists and doctors
right.
roaming around
right.
India.
So let's get real.
Right. You know, when you get real, the total number of people who are really in all this high-tech stuff is less than a million people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the India graduates for 250,000 engineers, out of which maybe 2,000-3,000 would be like, you know, going to good schools and so on.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can ever duplicate what United States has. United States attracts the best and the brightest.
Even now, the cream of the crop still coming to the U.S.?
You cannot duplicate, for example, MIT anywhere else in the world.
But we hear a lot about the Indian Institute of Technology lately, how hard it is to get in there.
I'm a graduate of IIT, and I know what it's like.
Okay.
And you cannot duplicate MIT, Harvard, Stanford, anywhere else in the world.
We have an awful lot of callers who want to join us. I want to begin to turn them to them. Anand is calling from Burlington, North Carolina. Hi, Anand. What do you think, my friend?
Hey, Tom.
Hi.
You wanted the opinion of people who had emigrated here and, you know, compare themselves with the situation back in India right now?
Yes, please.
Yeah. And I came here in 97 to Minneapolis as a software developer.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've made a mistake.
Why?
Because the people I worked with, the guys who stuck around, they're doing extremely well for themselves.
India?
Yeah, yeah.
So can you consider going back? Do you consider going back, Anand?
I don't know yet. I'm going to India in a couple of weeks' time for a vacation. I'm definitely going to be asking around, you know, see how things are.
So it sounds like you're looking back with a little envy at your friends who have ridden the boom wave back home. Where is home for you in India, Anand?
What's that?
In Madras, sure. Great. Anand, thanks for your call. Sukheta Mehta, I want to put that to you. You've said, of course, it's heart-wrenching to see American programmers, many of whom are of Indian origin, lose their jobs and have to worry about how they'll pay the mortgage. Here's Anand thinking maybe he should have ridden the wave in India.
Exactly. Anand is a textbook example of what I'm speaking about. He might be thinking, if I'd stayed in India by now, I might not have an American salary, but I could have many servants in my house, my children would be getting an excellent education, and most importantly, I won't have to leave my family. I won't be sundered from my culture and the trees I grew up amongst and my friends to go to another country. What if I just stayed there? So when we read all this news about outsourcing, this is a thought that crosses a lot of our minds. Did our parents make the right decision? And what do we need to teach our children in order to prepare them for the 21st century? Do we need to, they already know English, should we start teaching them Hindi or Tamil?
And you say you're making darn sure that you're doing just that. Let me get another call here. Dan is calling from San Diego in California. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Tom, great show and very appropriate topic. I don't think most of us Indian Americans regret having come here at all. In fact, I think we got the best of both worlds because most of us came here, say, after our bachelor's degrees.
Right.
And as some of the other speakers have said, it's very tough to complete your bachelor's with high marks to be able to come to the U.S. So we got battle-hardened there.
Yes.
Plus, we got battle-hardened here because we had no safety nets to seek help from when we were coming up, making $578 a month in scholarships, that kind of situation.
Mm-hmm.
So now, in fact, we are in a unique situation where we had a perspective from both views of the being on both sides of the table, and many of us, like Raj, who are going back, are benefiting from having been on both sides of the table. In my personal example, I got my bachelor's in India.
Yes.
I got 4 degrees in the U.S., 2 master's, PhD, and MBA. But I am more proud of my bachelor's in India than 4 degrees in U.S. combined.
Because the competition was so stiff there?
The competition was so stiff, and I spent all my time here doing research and had no time for studying for the exams, and still maintaining a GPA of 3.8 wasn't a big deal to begin with. So I do agree that the graduate studies in the U.S. are a lot better. The bachelor's degree in India for many colleges, and I won't necessarily say every college, but top 30% of the colleges is at least as difficult, if not a lot more difficult.
And Dan, do you see your personal economic future? You're in San Diego. Do you see your economic future in the United States or in India?
It can be in both places because a lot of us here who came here have been infected by the entrepreneurial virus the way Raj has been, and many of us are actively pursuing aspects where we can benefit from our education, business background, as well as cultural understanding of being on both sides of the table.
Yeah, we hear that. It sounds like a good position to be in. Dan, thanks for calling. Rishika, I see you nodding here in Boston to the idea of the best of both worlds.
Exactly.
It feels that way to you.
Exactly. And that is how I have been living my life. I have been taking advantage of the best of both worlds. I travel to India every other year or so, take the artifacts or take the clothes. I mean, I go shopping and I go on shopping sprees in India.
Right.
And now when I bring those things back, I'm proud to wear them in front of the American crowd,
Sure.
Which the attitude has really changed. The American public has become more accepting of the Indian culture and its traditions and so forth. So I'm proud to display those items.
So the way you describe it tonight, it's like a great stroke of luck to have the old country come booming up behind
exactly.
you as you get rooted in the United States. We're talking tonight with Indian Americans about the rise of India and the future of America. You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services.
Are we headed into a great age of dual citizenship? India and America, China and America, fill in the blank. And is it good for the United States to have citizens with a foot in both worlds? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I've got a terrific lineup of Indian Americans with us tonight. With me in the studio, Rishika Dua, 23-year-old heading into medical school at George Washington University, and Desh Deshpande. He was co-founder and chairman of the high-tech company Sycamore Networks, made a big killing with Cascade Communications, which is sold for $3.7 billion in 1997. He's also the philanthropist behind the Deshpande Center for Technological Innovation at MIT. We're joined from Washington by Mitra Kalita. She's a Washington Post bureau business correspondent and author of Suburban Sahibs, and from Brooklyn, New York, author of Maximum City, Bombay Lost and Found by Sukhita Mehta. A lot of callers want to join us as well, and I want to turn to them. Kieran's calling from Maynard, Massachusetts. Hi, Kieran. You're on the air. What do you think?
Well, I'm actually calling about my father. I was born in the States.
Great.
With an American mother, my father from India, and he immigrated in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And when I went to India with him as an adult, I could see almost a fear of returning to India, based on the poverty that he was recalling from his childhood.
Still a visceral fear of what he went through. So he didn't come out of a middle or upper class background in India. He knew the poverty there firsthand.
Yes, and he was very poor growing up, and he would look around, and I could see that he had really no desire to return to live. He enjoyed being there and seeing his family, and he enjoyed being there when he was able to be in a middle class situation.
But how recently have you been back, Kieran, or your father been back, for that matter?
He actually doesn't choose to go back very frequently anymore because he's also brought a lot of his family here.
Mm.
So, you know, he does have some family there, but not very much anymore. Mm. So the last time he was back was in the late 90s.
The late 90s. Of course, things were coming along then, but they've continued since then. Kieran, thanks for your call. Desh Deshpande, let me ask you about that. There was a time, one of my big impressions of India, this was, again, in the 70s, was if you fell out of your place in society in India, you could fall an awfully long way. I mean, there basically was no floor there. Is it still the same today?
You know, I think life in India is still very hard. You know, you don't get electricity, you don't have water, traffic jams, pollution. So it isn't easy. But what's exciting is just the hope that a few of the industries have brought to the country. So certainly now there's some youngsters who are making a good living, making more money than their parents do, mm-hmm. and so on. So it's a spark of hope, and that it's that spark of hope that sort of is really getting the country moving forward,
sending a tremor right through the whole country.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So you know, if you compare to, let's say, a living standard in Boston, I mean, this would be so much more comfortable than you could live anywhere in India. But at the same
even
point,
in these new sort of golden streets of Bangalore.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But what makes it exciting is the rate of change.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they had absolutely nothing. They have a little bit now. And so it's the spark of hope.
Anand is calling from Sudbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Anand. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I was born in the U.S., but my parents are from India, and I've visited there on a number of occasions. And what I worry about is that while India has made a lot of progress in IT and other high-tech sectors, I worry that unless they get their act together on things like, you know, sanitation and water supplies and power supply and education, the economic boom is going to fizzle out. And, I mean, I definitely want India to become a great power and to be an ally of the U.S., but at the same time, I think that it's a bit naive of the Indian diplomatic community to expect to be treated as a great power when, I mean, really, they haven't quite earned it yet.
Well, I mean, but it's a huge country. They've got a big economy. They broke into the top 10 just in the last year I'm reading here. I mean, and if you can be treated as a great power, why not? Isn't that what diplomats are supposed to do, Anand?
I agree, but I really think that India is, or I worry that they're kind of, it's all kind of going to their head. They're thinking, oh, we have all this IT, we're such a great country. But really, last time I was there, I saw, you know, people are importing BMWs to the country, but there are no roads to drive them on. They have widescreen TVs, but no power with which to watch them. You know, Western beauty products, but no water in the sink. So I'm not sure I see the point.
So it's still a kind of checkered picture there, as Desh Deshpande has described. Anand, thanks for your call. Desh?
Yeah, Anand, I think I agree with you. You know, it's but the good thing about India is it's democracy. In fact, the last election, when they fought it, the Congress came into the power because they sort of said India Shining was the slogan for the current political party, and they said shining on whom? And that was the sort of slogan that got the current government into power. And the fact
saying,
that
let it shine more broadly on more Indians, not just a few.
And in fact, you know, Amartya Sen has a new book called The Argumentative Indian, which actually talks about how there is a sort of a tradition of argumenting and the democracy
Absolutely.
In India,
sure.
Which I think is very healthy. And I think India definitely needs to pay attention to the things that Anand is talking about.
Let's get another call. Anil is calling from Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Anil. You're on the air.
Hi, I was calling about exactly the point that you are making now, and thank you for taking my call, Tom.
Sure, sure.
Somebody's
there at the door, Neil.
No, it's my little daughter.
Okay.
Yep. And my feeling when I came here first, I immigrated in 99. Uh-huh. I work as a physician. I really moved here for economic opportunity more than anything else, I think. And when I came here, one of the things that struck me was there were really only two political voices. Whereas I come from a state in India called Kerala, where we have hundreds of political parties, regional parties, local parties, and it's usually a multitude of voices in the political spectrum. And I kind of felt stifled when I came here. I was less free. I don't know if that's really the right word to use.
do you still feel that the American conversation
still
is less free than India's?
Yep, I do still feel that, even more so after 9/11. I feel as if the freedom in this country is much less than what I originally had in India.
So, and what about your commitment to your status as an American? Do you see it for the long term? Is your family here forever? Do you see a foot in both countries? How do you look at it?
See, I don't see myself returning to India at all. I do think that my family, my daughter's born here. She's growing up here, and I'm not really certain that I will ever return. But my decisions are more economic than anything else, I think.
Right, and here you are rooted right in the United States and in Wisconsin. You know, Mitra Kalita, again, it was years ago that I studied Telugu, that Southeast Indian language, at the University of Wisconsin there in Madison. It was a very small little troop of Americans who had that interest in the mid-70s. I wonder what you think about in relations between these countries, the U.S. and India. Will they be dominated by Indian Americans because they've got the language skills, they've got the cultural awareness, or is there a place for, you know, a broader circle of Americans in that relationship as well?
Oh, it's interesting that you say that because I think a lot of the Indians who are going back are often going back making the American dollars that Suketu talked about, but to head up U.S. operations of companies in India.
Mm-hmm.
So they sort of have that duality, so they're able to speak the language, both, you know, linguistically as well as kind of the cultural language in India. But there are, at least from anecdotally what I've heard, there are many, you know, white Americans who are also being sent over you know, General Electric, for example, I know employs many in outside of Delhi, Bangalore as well. There has sort of been an emergence of, you know, I guess a white American group.
Kind of managerial class
that
there,
I'm aware of. And in fact, last time I was in India, when I was in Delhi, there was a happy hour at a bar for expatriate Americans who were getting together. Now, this has, you know, been common among diplomatic types for years, but now you're starting to see more techies and others.
A real business community there. And Sukheta Mehta, you, in your essay last week, you kind of put a shot over the bow of Americans saying, listen, Indians had to play catch-up here for many years, and they put their nose to the grindstone, they did their homework, and they did it. If you want to stay in the game, you're going to have to do the same thing. You're going to have to compete with the mathematicians and everything else out of India. Do you see that happening in the United States?
Well, what I referred to in the article was the legacy of colonialism, where the British essentially made sure that our industries didn't develop so that they wouldn't compete with this.
India could grow the cotton, but they wanted to make the textiles in Birmingham.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And now we're not only making the textiles, we're making the machines that make the textiles.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to catch up after 1947. We had to work harder than other countries who had had their independence much earlier. And as an American now, I see that this country has to import much of its technical labor. If you look at the number of PhDs which went to foreign-born candidates in the last year in
the sciences, engineering,
sciences.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think it formed the majority of the PhDs.
Mm-hmm.
The country has to pay more attention to these areas, and it's still the world leader in terms of innovation, there's no doubt about it. But there, if you look at the level of a school education, if my sons who go to an excellent private school in New York, if they had to go to a school in Bombay, they would have to take remedial math and science classes. And this is not a healthy development for America.
That's a wake-up call. Amitava is calling from Lynn, Massachusetts. Hi, Amitava. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
So I want to just make a comment. So three friends of mine and myself, we all came to the U.S. to do our PhD and in biological sciences. And now two of them actually went back. One joined the biotech sector, one joined the pharmaceutical sector, and I am planning to go back next year.
So two out of four already gone back, and you, the third, headed back. What's drawing you?
So I think it's the buzz, the optimism, everything combined. I just recently went to India for family reasons, where my dad was receiving treatment, and I saw the level of treatment that he is getting. It's pretty good. I saw the roads. I saw the infrastructure. It's pretty much getting there. And I thought that it's the time that we should dive in, help in the cause, and perhaps contribute my few cents. Like I'm a Harvard-trained scientist. I'm trying to go back, and maybe I can join forces with others.
Amitava, are you a U.S. citizen at this point?
No, I came to the U.S. in 1995, and I'm still an immigrant.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So did you imagine you would become a citizen? Do you still intend to become a citizen?
Well, I really wanted to. Like, there was a point I was not contemplating on going back at all, but the things changed in last 4 or 5 years, at least visibly, when... I'm not going to get into the professional nuances, but I can tell you this much, that there are certain things scientifically that I can do in India, perhaps slightly easier than in the U.S. It's not just money. It's not all about money. It's about manpower. It's about ease of getting certain things done. And so I changed my mind, and I realized that I can pursue science at a pretty good level, even while being in India, and enjoy my family and my country as well.
Amitava, we've got the picture, and it's a very interesting one. We thank you for calling in with that. Desh Deshpande, how do you see this relationship, the symbiosis between the U.S. and India? Do you see it leaning in the U.S. favor, in India's favor? There's been lots of moaning about outsourcing in the United States and some concern looking into the future. Is it to the mutual benefit? Is it a zero-sum game? Is one country's the other's lost? How do you see it?
Right. You know, I talked about value creation, right? So what's happening now is that the more and more bigger and bigger population of the world is getting into the economic game.
Sure.
And so as a result of that, you know, there's a lot of motivated people in India, in China, and so on, who are able to do things and contribute things at a lower cost.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, because of the asymmetrical motivation, they even do the job better.
Asymmetrical motivation. In other words, they're motivated because they're on the upswing. They've got places to
go. No. If there's the same job
yes.
that somebody can do here and somebody can do there,
uh-huh.
the person who does the job there is probably more qualified and feel very honored to be mm-hmm. doing that job.
To be doing it,
and therefore
right.
they'll pay a tremendous amount of attention and
mm-hmm,
so on.
Mm-hmm.
And so the job gets done better,
mm-hmm.
right? But that's really not that different than when the computers came along. You know, what computers did was they increased productivity.
Mm-hmm.
And the biggest concern 20, 30 years ago was if the computers came along, what are the rest of the people going to do? Everybody's going to lose their jobs.
Mm.
And what's happening with like India coming into the picture, China coming into the picture, the productivity is going up quite a bit, which means within the given amount of resources, we can do more things. And we can do things that we never thought were possible.
So good for everyone or the U.S. loss?
Good for everybody and even better for U.S.
Because
U.S. is the only place which is very creative and which is very flexible in terms of making best use of the resources.
You were in Washington just today at lunch with Prime Minister Singh and with Condoleezza Rice, U.S. Secretary of State. What was on her mind at that lunch?
Well, I think both of them were very upbeat on the relationship because they feel that both the countries are grounded in the same values. They're both very diverse. They're not religious extremists.
Mm-hmm.
They're both very big democracies, freedom of thought. So all these basic values are well shared.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel that if they really come together, that this would be a very excellent relationship.
Rishika, you're 23 years old. You're headed into medical school in the United States. As you look out on the big horizon of your life, where do you see it unfolding, U.S. or India?
Perhaps both, I would say that. I wouldn't leave India, and I wouldn't uproot myself from the U.S. either. And I think that's reflective of how I've grown up. I have lived half my life in India, and I've had half my life here, and I'd like to keep it that way because I am enjoying myself very much.
You ought to be. Mitra Kalita, do you hear the future in that 23-year-old's view of her own future?
You know, I have my future, I think, will similarly be in both countries. I have a 10-month-old daughter, and I won't predict hers, though, because I think she has sort of India has a few more years before she's going to have to make that choice. So.
Before it can really make a claim on her. 10 months old and a whole century stretching out
That's
before
right.
her. Wow, and what a century it's going to be. Indian Americans in a very interesting spot in it. We really appreciate all of you sharing your perspectives tonight. I want to thank you, Rishika Dua, here with us in Boston. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
And Desh Deshpande, Guru Raj Deshpande, co-founder of Sycamore Networks. Thanks a lot for being with us tonight. Just great having you.
Thank you, Tom.
Sukhita Mehta, wonderful book, Maximum City. We loved talking about it before, about Bombay, Lost and Found, and wonderful to have you again tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Mitra Kalita, joining us tonight from Washington, author of Suburban Sahib's Three Immigrant Families and Their Passage from India to America. Mitra, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Michael Garth, Marika Bukas, Alan Kuchel, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio. Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, sponsoring new, small, rigorous high schools around the country that prepare students for college, work, and citizenship. GatesFoundation.org. The Pew Charitable Trust, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at PewTrusts.org. And the Kresge